I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 21st of November. The enthusiastic and knowledgeable Jeff Greenfield is our guest this hour of the program. He has thought about this long and hard. What if John Fitzgerald Kennedy had survived the assassination in Dallas 50 years ago tomorrow? What if the bubble top had been on the limousine and he had been wounded but not mortally wounded? How might Kennedy's instincts, his understanding of history, his core impulses have informed actions on civil rights, on Vietnam, Cuba? Jeff is the author of If Kennedy Lived, the First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy in Alternate History. Jeff, of course, an Emmy Award-winning analyst. He's been a correspondent and commentator for CBS, ABC, CNN, and PBS, columnist for Time Magazine, writer for Harper's and the New York Times. He worked as a speechwriter for Senator Robert F. Kennedy and New York Mayor John Lindsay. He's the author of all kinds of books, including Then Everything Changed, his account of the 2000 election, Television, the First 50 Years, Playing to Win, An Insider's Guide to Politics, and many other books. And he is an undergraduate. His undergraduate work was done, I believe, at UW-Madison. So many of our guests went to Madison. It's just incredible. We'll be welcoming phone calls as you entertain that question as well. What would a second term have looked like? Would there have been a second term? Would he have been reelected, too? You can entertain that question. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Jeff Greenfield, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. I did indeed go to the University of Wisconsin, and it's about this time of year when I realize why I didn't settle in Madison. It's a wonderful city, but between November and April, I'm in Santa Barbara right now, which explains
why. All right, Santa Barbara. Okay, it makes us rugged, though, and we work really hard, right?
For sure.
That's what happens when you're here. What a fascinating thought to have had and to have let your mind go in an informed direction, because you sure know the history here, but to use the history to inform what might have been. It's just a really interesting book to have written, isn't it?
Well, yes. In fact, it's the second effort I've had at this, or actually the third, if you can, an e-book. I did the book Then Everything Changed, was a trio of stories involving near-miss twists of fate, one that John Kennedy himself was almost killed before he ever got to be president,
right,
by a suicide bomber, you know. But the interesting thing about this, Kathleen, is that there are some historians who deride this notion. They think it's a parlor game,
yep,
sci-fi. They say it's like asking what if Spartacus had a jet. But then there are others, including a couple that helped me on this book, Doris Kearns Goodwin, mm-hmm, Mike Lepeschloss, to name two, who think, no, if you ask what might have happened, it's a clue to what really did happen, in the sense that it shows you how different leaders with different impulses, as you mentioned at the outset, different premises, would produce very different results. And so it's not simply an exercise in fantasizing or wishful thinking. It's a way of saying, all right, what do we know about what real history was and,
mm-hmm,
what might have been different that gives us clues? And that's why I find it so fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I think historians do that as well. We had Dalek on a few weeks ago, and he was talking about how he didn't think that Kennedy would live the second term because of the Addison's disease. He would have died. He was that sick.
Yeah, that's one of the more contentious arguments, because another historian, I was on Charlie Rose Show with both Dalek and Richard Reeves.
Oh, were you?
Reeves, I think that'll be on either tonight or tomorrow.
Oh.
Richard Reeves thinks that Kennedy was actually in better health by the time he died, because he'd finally gotten the medical care that he should have. But it raises all kinds of questions about, and I think the most obvious area of controversy is Vietnam. Is, you know, how did that war get escalated? What were Lyndon Johnson's notions,
mm-hmm,
and why were they so different, in my view, from John Kennedy's? So that even with the same set of advisors, and even though John Kennedy had put the combat advisors into Vietnam, why, in my opinion, he would not have escalated that war. So you ask questions about, well, did Kennedy personalized the war. 2 days after his death, Johnson said, I'm not going to be the first American president to lose a war.
Mm-hmm.
Just not how Kennedy thought. How different were they in their trust of their military advisors? Kennedy was much more skeptical than Johnson was. He'd been through all kinds of incidents, from the Bay of Pigs to the missile crisis to Berlin to others, where the military had made assurances that turned out not to be so. So that you ask those questions and you say, ah, it seems to me probable that if John Kennedy had been president after November 22nd, we would not have found ourselves in a position where a couple of years later, hundreds of thousands of Americans were fighting, and God knows how many Vietnamese were dying under the sustained bombing. That's my view. But you have to go to history to draw a plausible conclusion, I think.
And you, in the book, talk about his comments. I think this was the day before he went to Dallas, a State Department aide, who and he said to him, I want you to organize an in-depth study of every possible option we've got in Vietnam, including how to get out. We have to review this whole thing from the bottom to the top.
Right. That is one of the last things he said, and I, in fact, create in my book that top-to-bottom review. And the quotes that Kennedy utters at that imaginary meeting are, in fact, quotes he really said,
mm-hmm.
namely that he didn't think we had a prayer of staying there, he put it very impolitely, they were going to throw our rear ends out. He put it more colorfully. But that, and this was the calculating political part of Kennedy, if he tried to do that before he was reelected, he said we'd have another McCarthy scare on our hands.
Mm-hmm.
I can't give up a piece of territory to the communists. I can do it after I'm reelected. I'm willing to take the political heat, but not now. So that what I don't imagine is some kind of Aaron Sorkin kind of speech to the country where he says, we can't win, we're getting out, it doesn't really matter, it doesn't affect our national security, we shouldn't be linked to the domino theory. What I imagine is a careful, stealth withdrawal done under the protective radar of people like Senator Richard Russell of Georgia, a hawk who nonetheless was very skeptical about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
There's a famous phone call that Richard Russell has with Lyndon Johnson where he's all but begging Johnson to figure out a way not to escalate. And I just transpose that and make Kennedy at the other end, who would have been much more receptive.
Right.
That's for me, that's the fun and the value of alternate history.
Mm-hmm.
Just imagine a different player hearing that same cautionary note from an otherwise very hawkish senator and thinking, oh, I think I can figure out a way to get us out of Vietnam without bringing the wrath of every hawk in the Senate down on me.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Johnson, and Johnson figures so prominently in so many fairly negative ways with the Kennedys. I'm interested in hearing more about the Senate investigation and the Life magazine investigation, which evidently was in full swing right before the Kennedy assassination
On the very day. A Senate committee was getting testimony from an insurance agent named John Reynolds that Johnson had demanded kickbacks in return for buying an expensive insurance policy. Johnson had had a heart attack in 55 and was not the most desirable risk, and demanded luxury furnishings in return for that. There were canceled checks being handed over to a Senate investigator almost at the moment Kennedy was shot. Meanwhile, in New York, Life magazine was convening a team of investigators to ask, how did a guy on the public payroll all his life accumulate a net worth of $14 million, which was the equivalent, I guess, today of about $140 million?
Mm.
And the answers were pretty clear that he'd done it by using his power to, in his wife's name, get the only radio and then television stations in Austin, Texas, to make a whole bunch of financial deals where clearly his influence was behind them. Now, with Kennedy's death, those investigations stopped, at least as they affected Johnson, because neither Life magazine nor a Senate committee wanted to throw into the mix of a traumatized and shocked nation the idea that their new president might be a lawbreaker.
Mm-hmm.
But if you posit Kennedy surviving, then you can see Life magazine saying, this guy Johnson's a heartbeat from the presidency.
Right.
He almost assumed the White House. We've got to find out what's up. And so I think the chances were very good that Johnson could not have politically survived that kind of inquiry, and that we might have had, it wasn't a matter even of dumping Johnson from the ticket. It might have been, as with Vice President Agnew, a forced resignation. Mm.
And if Kennedy had lived and this information was published, would Kennedy have thought twice about keeping him on the ticket with these revelations, even though they
had...
Well,
as I just said, I don't think it would have come to that. I think Johnson would have been forced out of office because there was the threat of criminal prosecution.
Before the re-election.
Yeah, sure. This all would have come up very early in 1964.
I see.
And I'm imagining in the book I wrote, I imagine Johnson, you know, for health reasons, because he always got sick when he was in political trouble, resigning.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fascinating.
Robert Caro in his penultimate, I hope, volume about Johnson's life speculates just this way, and also suggests that Kennedy might have had other reasons not to want him on the ticket. Because with the South all but gone in 64 because of Kennedy's civil rights stand, mm-hmm. he might have needed a vice president with strength in what would be the critical states of like Ohio, California, Illinois, Michigan, big states that were out of the South. But that's what an alternate historian like me gets to do. You get to speculate
right.
based on plausibility.
Yeah, and think about somebody like Stuart Symington, who I haven't thought of in a long time.
Yeah, that's not a name that's going to be familiar to many people, certainly not under my age. But he was supposed to be. Everybody assumed he was Kennedy's pick back in 1960. And it was a real shock to a lot of people and almost caused an upheaval at the convention when Kennedy picked Johnson. But when you look at how that election in 1960 played out, that's one of the few cases in American history where a vice president may well have turned the tide. I mean, it was a very narrow victory in Texas. Some people think not entirely kosher based on the vote counting. But it's very hard to imagine Kennedy carrying Texas and there are a couple of other southern states that he carried fairly narrowly without Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, well, the speculation is if, with a vice president under twin investigations for ethical and possibly legal violations, you can easily imagine Johnson not being there. By the time the re-election happens.
Well, and you also write about, which is interesting to think about, I hadn't thought about this before, Kennedy's reason for being there was to shore up support because he needed Texas for re-election, so he's thinking about that. But you also raise the question as to whether or not Johnson was going to be able to give him that kind of support, whether or not...
Well, this is borrowed freely from a lot of historians, including most recently Caro, that... He was a much less powerful figure in Texas than he'd been as a senator, because mm-hmm. the vice president back then had no power. And the Texas Democratic Party was totally split between liberals led by Senator Yarbrough and conservatives led by Governor Connally. And Johnson may not have been able to do anything about that. So that's all part of the reason for thinking that had Kennedy lived, although I think the ethical and legal challenges were much more... potentially fatal to Johnson politically, that he just might not have been around to be on the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he would have been back in Texas.
Right. Let's talk about some of the warnings. I've always been haunted by Edley Stevenson's experience in Texas and his warning that, you know, maybe it really wasn't a good idea for Kennedy to go to that area because he'd been so roughed up. Can you talk about that? And was he given other warnings by many other people that maybe Dallas was not a place to go, or Texas for that matter?
Well, there were, and Dallas was particularly a center of very, very far right-wing folks. H.L. Hunt, a very rich and highly conservative figure, had published an ad in the paper the day Kennedy came, and black, you know, basically accusing him of selling out to the communists. But, and I think this is really important, if you believe, as I do, that Lee Oswald was the lone assassin, then the whole Dallas is a city of hate, you know, we're all guilty, it turns out to be a really serious error in judgment. And it's one of those things that I think I think was an unfortunate consequence of that kind of attitude. In other words, the person who, in my view, killed Kennedy was not at all influenced by the kind of feverish far-right hatreds. Lee Harvey Oswald was a self-taught, not very well-taught Marxist with delusions of grandeur, a lifelong propensity toward violence and a conviction that he was designed to play this outsized role in history. In that sense, he was a lot like a lot of other assassins and would-be assassins, like the man that almost blew up Kennedy, mm-hmm. Richard Pavlik in 1960, like Giuseppe Zangara, who almost killed Roosevelt, like the man who shot and killed Garfield or McKinley. So that if you've harbored the conspiracy theories, then this makes sense to say, well, he shouldn't have gone to Dallas, it was this city of hate. But if you believe, as I do, that it was a twisted, deranged, insignificant figure who saw his one chance at history, then it does. Then that connection breaks. And so I think the whole argument, Earl Waring in his eulogy for Kennedy talked about the hate that surrounded him, it helped really put a really dark cast on America's sense of itself. It was bad enough that a president had been killed in broad daylight in a major city at a time when that was unthinkable.
Right.
But I think that the analysis that he was killed by hate, it doesn't fit the facts.
Mm. You mentioned Pavlik. For those who have not read your previous book, this is something that I never knew when I was growing up about it was a very close assassination attempt. And then you speculate, well, if that had happened, there would be no Kennedy legacy, no Kennedy presidency. This guy came really close to killing the president. Can you tell
Seconds
us that?
Away.
Tell us that story.
Yeah. It's one of the most overlooked stories in American political history. That's December 1960. Kennedy's in Palm Beach, Florida, working on his inaugural. And this this retired postal worker from New Hampshire with a passionate hatred of the Catholic Church and the Kennedy family is parked in front of his house in a car loaded with dynamite. And his plan is to ram Kennedy's car as he's being driven to church and blow himself and Kennedy up. And apparently, because Jacqueline Kennedy came to the door with Carolyn to say, see him off, Pavlik, out of a twisted sense of chivalry, said, I don't want to do this in front of his family. But the Secret Service chief said it was a matter of seconds. And, that's how close we came to never having a President Kennedy. It shows you one of the major themes of this book and the last book is how contingent history is, how often it turns on these weird, small twists of fate, like this lunatic's sense of chivalry or the fact that the rain stopped in Dallas and so the bubble top came off.
Right. Yeah, right. Well, welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Jeff Greenfield. His book is If Kennedy Lived, The First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy, An Alternate History. How would you answer that question when you think about that? Let your mind go there for a while, informed, of course, by your knowledge of President Kennedy and your knowledge of history and all the issues that he was dealing with at that time, nuclear weapons proliferation, peace in the world, that foreign policy issue was of primary importance to him. Civil rights, we need to talk more about civil rights and fascinating stories about Dr. Martin Luther King's father. Vietnam. Just to name a few. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, you can use that, is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to go there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeff Greenfield is our guest. His book is If Kennedy Lived, The First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy, An Alternate History. We'll take phone calls in a moment. Rob Ferret and Veronica Ricker talk about America's growing trash trade today on Central Time. All right, let's start our phone calls with Rich in Rhinelander. Hey, Rich.
Hi. Jeff, you and I were contemporaries at Madison. I would have graduated the same year you did, except I went into the war on poverty in a vain attempt to avoid being drafted. Mm. And if you haven't kept up with it, Jeff, we lost. The people who want more poor in America won. But to my question, I've long thought America, in the contingencies of history, was very fortunate that George Washington did not have any biological offspring. In terms of the Kennedy family and clan, the children, despite our wanting or desiring to be a democratic republic, Americans seem to have a great love for bloodline lineage. And there was John and there was Carolyn. And I guess I'll leave Liz and Mary Cheney out of this theory at this time. I'm wondering if you have or you would care to speculate on how the trajectory for the Kennedy larger family might have changed had JFK lived, particularly in terms of his children and their potential in American government.
Thanks, Rich.
Well, the broadest point I can make is that politics is an astonishingly a family business in America. For all the, you know, we don't have the Constitution particularly specifically says no titles of nobility. We don't have, you know, inherited peerages. But an extraordinary number of political people, it's in their blood. They see it from the time they're kids. And the number of people who work in the House and Senate and governors who are blood relatives of other politicians, it's really quite astounding. I actually did a piece when I was on television about this. I mean, people you wouldn't even think of, you know, that the Kathleen Sebelius is the daughter of a governor of Ohio. Mm-hmm. This goes throughout that. In terms of the Kennedy children, it's actually Robert's children more were politically active. Joe Jr. was a congressman. Kathleen Kennedy Townsend sought the governorship of Maryland and lost. One of Robert Kennedy's grandsons has just been elected to the Congress. I think he's 28. But neither Carolyn nor John Kennedy Jr. had, except for a brief period when Carolyn sought the Senate seat being vacated by Hillary Clinton and did it quite awkwardly. They didn't evidence any signs. John, you know, did George Magazine, which was a magazine about politics, and clearly people were interested in it, in him as a possible political candidate, but he didn't seem to have any real appetite for it. So that's beyond that I really can't speculate. I refer glancingly in the book to my notion that had John Kennedy lived for and served for 8 years, Robert Kennedy would have had a very difficult time mm-hmm. having a political foothold. You know, he would have been working under Jack, I think, as Secretary of Defense in his second term, with no political base. He couldn't have run in Virginia. They would never have elected him. He couldn't run in New York. There was no reason for him to go to New York, absent John Kennedy's death. He couldn't go back to Massachusetts. His brother was a senator. So in that sense, that would have been truncated. And actually, the family that's probably had the most success is the Bush family, and I now see that the nephew of George W., I guess Jeb's son, mm-hmm. so I think that's right, is running for a state office in Texas. So you might be looking at the wrong family to ask this question.
Thanks, Rich, very much for the call. Scott's going to move us into the area of civil rights, and there's a lot to talk about in this area. Scott, hi.
Hi there, Kathleen. I'm enjoying this program immensely, as I always do. And my question for you, sir, is I've heard it argued that one of the things that got the civil rights agenda that President Johnson proposed through was the country having the sympathy of the country in the wake of the assassination. And I'm wondering if Kennedy had survived and said, say, been wounded but functional enough to remain active as president, do you think that the sympathy factor that he would have generated from his recent horrifying escape from death then made the country want to have his agenda through and smooth the way for a similar civil rights action?
What I think is that the death of John Kennedy was a very powerful emotional lever for Lyndon Johnson to get the 1964, particularly the 64 Public Accommodations Act passed. He said in his very first speech to the Congress, nothing could serve as a more fitting memorial to President Kennedy. He also, though, had other advantages. The fact that he was a Southerner made him, I think, more acceptable. Not that the South, not that the Southern segregationists would have welcomed him, but it was less of a threat than a Boston politician. Also, maybe most important, Johnson knew the Senate better than anybody, probably who ever lived. He was, to quote another book by Carroll, master of the Senate. So what I think is that it's likely that John Kennedy would have had much more difficulty, particularly with the Public Accommodations Act. That's the one that opened restaurants and hotels and other public accommodations, to blacks who were being denied service. I think the Voting Rights Act would have been, in some sense, easier because the issue is, no pun intended, so clearly black and white. I mean, you can at least imagine how a segregationist would say, well, you know, I should have a right to have whomever I want in my restaurant. It's wrong constitutionally, but you can see it. But to argue that somebody should be denied the right to vote because of his or her skin color, even the segregationists couldn't really say that with a straight face. So they had to make up other reasons. So the shorthand version of this is, I think civil rights would have happened eventually. I think it, because the moral force of the argument was too strong, but I think it would have been much harder for Kennedy than for Johnson to have passed that particular civil rights bill.
Thanks very much, Scott. There are some fascinating stories about Dr. Martin Luther King. Let's talk about these for a moment. You write that the Republican Party was a serious contender for the Negro vote. Richard Nixon had so impressed Martin Luther King Jr. with his commitment to equality that most of King's associates were betting that he would endorse Nixon. The story about his father is really fascinating. One of the most influential ministers in America, Jeff, signing a newsletter endorsing Nixon out of fear of a Catholic in the White House, but changing his mind. Why?
Well, this is another example of where history turns on a dime. Mm-hmm. Or in this case, the two dimes that went and paid for two phone calls. late in the campaign, just a few weeks before the election day, King was arrested at a demonstration in Georgia, and a hard shell racist judge, based on a phony parole violation charge, sentenced him to a few months of hard labor in a rural prison, out of which his wife was sure he would never emerge alive. So the King family indirectly reached out to the Kennedys, and John Kennedy called Mrs. King to express concern. Robert Kennedy at first was furious. He thought this had blown a bunch of southern states. And then he called the judge and said, you know, you might want to think about this. And ultimately, King was released on bail, whereupon King's father said, you know, he didn't have to do this. This was a brave thing to do. I've got a suitcase full of votes that I'm going to deliver to this fine young man. There were 2 million leaflets circulated throughout black neighborhoods in major American cities. And if you look at the vote in 1960, it's entirely conceivable that the huge turnout in black neighborhoods for Kennedy, at a time when the Republican Party was indeed very competitive, that vote may have made the difference in getting Kennedy elected. If you look at several states where Kennedy won narrowly, and then you look at the turnout in black neighborhoods, and it's really instructive to believe that those phone calls and the endorsement by King's dad may have been the reason why John Kennedy got to be president.
Well, that's fascinating. That is just fascinating. And I loved his comment, which also says something a little bit about Kennedy's relationship with his father, endorsing, you know, the possibility of the elder King endorsing Nixon. Kennedy said to a campaign ad, well, we all have fathers, don't we?
Well, he said, imagine Martin Luther King's father a bigot, and then thinking about his dad's checkered history with the Jews. I said, well, we all have our fathers.
Yeah, we all do.
Yeah.
Colin is next in Madison. Hi, Colin.
Hi. I heard you speak earlier about some things that might have been better if Kennedy hadn't been assassinated. I was wondering if you think there's anything that would have been worse.
I think it's not a matter of better. It's a matter that civil rights would have been harder to pass. But if you look at Vietnam, I mean, let's just take that as the most obvious example. My belief is that John Kennedy would not have escalated the war, that by 1963 he was very different from the hawk who ran in 1960, that he had indeed put American advisors into Vietnam, but things weren't going well, that he'd learned that the military was not to be trusted when it gave these assurances about what it could do, and that he was always conscious of the dangers of a land war in Asia. He used to say to his aides, well, if you can convince Douglas MacArthur, maybe I would put combat troops in, because the military was constantly hammering at Kennedy, put combat troops in. And MacArthur, you know, had always said, just you'd never want to get into a land war in Asia. So if you believe, as I do, that Kennedy would have tap-danced through 1964, because he said quite clearly there was nothing he could do till he was reelected, it would be too politically toxic, and had gradually disengaged, then you're looking at a country, I mean, the United States, where we did not have 500,000 combat troops in Vietnam, where the late 60s, think about Madison, Wisconsin, where you're from and where I live.
Right.
You know, that Dow Chemical sit-in doesn't take place in 1965. The various, the State Street riots of, what was it, 1969 or 70, don't take place. But and you have to, expand on that nationally. You don't have a protest movement, some of whose elements turn extremely violent, extremely left, in the sense of embracing Ho Chi Minh and regarding the United States as the enemy. That doesn't happen if we don't have a Vietnam War. I talked to some of the leaders of the New Left. Tom Hayden told me he thought he might be working in an anti-poverty program.
Really?
Without a Vietnam War.
Huh.
You know, and groups like SDS would not have lurched into this twin lunacy of Maoism and Weather Underground philosophy because there wouldn't have been a war to protest. So that's one way I think that, you know, the country would have been in a very different and better place had Kennedy lived.
And what would have happened in terms of relationship with the Soviet Union, with Khrushchev, with nuclear disarmament, with proliferation of weapons? He really gave Khrushchev the benefit of the doubt in the whole Cuban Missile Crisis and gave him time to save face. How would that have been developed?
Well, that's one of the more interesting areas of speculation. Here you have two leaders of the two superpowers who had come very close to the precipice of nuclear holocaust. Dean Rusk once said, nobody who went through the missile crisis came out the same way he went in. And I think it's one of the reasons why Kennedy began talking about looking to re-examine our approach to the Soviet Union, see if there are common areas of agreement, see if we can begin to move away from the Cold War. So I imagine, and this is my imagination, you know, that there might have been a second summit in Moscow with Khrushchev, because the first one in Vienna had gone very badly for Kennedy. He'd been cowed by the Soviet leader's bluster and aggressiveness. I think it's possible, again, this is speculation, that Kennedy would have worked very hard to help Khrushchev domestically in terms of somehow making the life of the average Soviet consumer, which was pretty grim, better, and that maybe Khrushchev wouldn't have been ousted in that coup in 1964. And if you imagine that, that's how you can begin to see, you know, Kennedy in effect saying to Khrushchev indirectly through aides, through cutouts, I want out of Vietnam, but you've got to help me by telling your allies in the North to stop, you know, ease up on the attacks. Ease up on the guerrilla strikes, because I need running room of my own to get out. That's an imaginary, but I think plausible alternate history where they become they help each other mutually with their biggest problems back home. Khrushchev helping Kennedy trying to extricate out of Vietnam, and Kennedy trying to help Khrushchev at home so that he retains the support and is not removed from power.
More phone calls in a moment. Jeff Greenfield is our guest this hour. He's written a book, and Jeff, of course, has been a political analyst and commentator for a long time. He's worked for CBS, ABC, CNN, PBS, been a columnist for Time Magazine, was a speechwriter for Senator Bobby Kennedy, written for the New York Times and Harper's. So this book looks at what would have happened had there been a second term if the president had been wounded. We never got to the rain story. If it had been raining in Dallas, the bubble would have been up and he could have been dead as a result of the wounds, or he could have survived. And what would a second term have looked like? And it's really interesting to based on his informed knowledge of all that was going on politically and what Kennedy thought and what history tells us, to look at how things may have been different, which is pretty fascinating to think about. So we welcome your phone calls. If you'd like to join us, that would be okay and good. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page, use that if you'd like, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So we welcome phone calls for Jeff, and I'll give you the phones are coming in now, but let me give you the number one more time, 800-486-8655. Republican opposition in 1964, can we say who would have been the likely nominee?
Yeah, I think that's beyond speculation. I think it would almost surely have been Barry Goldwater, whether Kennedy or Johnson was in the White House, because the Republican Party conservatives who had felt robbed for decades, they felt that the Eastern, it's going to sound fairly familiar, in one sense it was a kind of precursor of a Tea Party feeling, that the Eastern establishment, which was then banks, major publications like Time and Life, the New York Herald Tribune, basically unfairly had control of the Republican Party. And by 1962 and 63, the conservatives were, as the McGovern folks were doing a decade later, were hard at work gaining control of state parties. And Barry Goldwater was their hero. And it seems pretty clear that at the time Kennedy went to Dallas, Goldwater was on his way to the nomination. He was personally a friend of Kennedy's. And after Kennedy's death, he thought for a while, I just don't want to do this. He was just sufficiently affected by the assassination. But then he did run. And I think certainly Kennedy wanted Goldwater as his opponent. He said at one of the few meetings they had about the 64 campaign, please give me Barry Goldwater. I won't even have to leave the White House.
Right.
And the fundamental reason was that even though Kennedy was in trouble on civil rights, not just in the South, but in big cities, the white working class, black tensions were growing already. The war and peace issue would have overwhelmed, I think, that campaign. And while I don't think Kennedy would have won in the Johnson landslide way, I believe it's pretty clear he would have been reelected.
He was more concerned about George Romney and Nelson Rockefeller.
Yeah, he thought that Rockefeller was vulnerable. There's a certain irony here, given Kennedy's life, that because Rockefeller had divorced his wife of many years and married a much younger woman, he thought that would be a real problem, which it turned out to be for Rockefeller. His wife gave birth to a child just before the California primary that reminded voters there that he had left his wife for a younger woman. But George Romney, governor of Michigan with very strong appeal to independence, very strong civil rights record, was the one that they really worried about. They thought he could really be a problem. And given what we know about the politics, then I think that's true. With Goldwater as the nominee, I just think it was pretty clear that there was no way the country was going to vote for Goldwater, because his notions about nuclear weapons, his sort of casual approach to them, that's like another weapon.
Mm-hmm.
In the wake of the missile crisis and the test ban treaty, I just think it would have been disabling for him, as it was.
And was there any self-examination when you talk about his saying, well, Rockefeller left his wife for another woman, so he's, you know, we're not as worried about him. For heaven's sake, what Kennedy was doing with other women was just astounding. Didn't he ever think, maybe I better stop this?
That's an unanswerable question, but it is one that is worth asking. You know, the behavior was so reckless as to just stagger the imagination even 50 years later. I mean, he knew, because his brother Robert had to get this information, that J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, knew all this stuff, particularly the stuff that would have been really damaging, because even in an age when the press basically said, you know, there's a private life, there's a public life, if you are involved with the mistress of a mafia leader, if you are dallying with a quote, party girl who, in Washington, who is suspected of being an Eastern intelligence agent, you are being reckless beyond the imagination of a novelist, almost.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody can quite figure out. Robert Dallek has, you know, and others have speculated. Well, he always thought he was going to die young because he was sick all of his life. And so he had this, you know, gather ye rosebuds while ye may. He felt invulnerable because he'd survived so long. He almost died in World War II. He had several life-threatening illnesses. He was almost killed in Palm Beach. So he may have felt, in some sense, invulnerable. He may have trusted that the public-private distinction would hold. And he may also have felt, as I speculate, that, you know, if somebody is threatening the president with exposure, there are tools a president has to try to keep those stories private. You know, there are all kinds of counter-pressures you can bring, even on a free press, if you're talking about things like antitrust suits, tax charges. In other words, what I'm suggesting here, and this is the less admirable side, I think, of the legacy, we know how the Kennedys behaved when the steel companies tried to raise their prices in 1962. It was not pretty.
Mm-hmm.
They were getting expense accounts of the steel executives to threaten them with exposure of maybe they were with people their wives wouldn't want them to be. So I think they would have played very hardball. But the question you raised, Kathleen, is I think it's unanswerable because, look, it's one thing to understand that, you know, people stray. People are powerfully attracted to dangerous situations. But for a president of the United States to behave this way is head shaking.
Right. Yeah, it is. It is.
I have a friend who's a psychotherapist and asked her, how do you explain it? And she just, you know, she says, beyond me.
Angie, our next caller in St. Francis. Hi.
Hello.
Yeah.
I would have wished that if Kennedy hadn't gotten killed, that in his second presidency, that the Kennedy-Cornyn Senate bill would have gotten passed. That was a bill for national health insurance.
Jeff, what about that?
Well, Kennedy tried in 1962 to get Medicare through the Congress and failed. And remember, this was a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House. But back then, many of the Democrats were conservatives, not just on civil rights, where they were, you know, the Southerners were segregationists. So even with what seemed like overwhelming numbers, he couldn't get Medicare through. So my guess is in a second term, he, you know, as Johnson did, he would have gotten Medicare through, that is, health care for the elderly. Whether he could have or even would have tried a national health insurance plan, I don't know. It's important that there's a lot of arguing about was he really a conservative, really a liberal. I mean, it's almost a meaningless conversation because it's half a century ago. But what is true, he was not a Hubert Humphrey kind of liberal. He was not a Lyndon Johnson liberal in the sense of believing that an expansive federal government was the answer to problems. So my feeling is it's hard to imagine that he would have gone all out for a full-throated national health insurance program, as his brother Ted did for much of his career in the Senate. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that's who Kennedy was. Medicare, yeah, because that was a logical extension of the New Deal, Social Security. So that's, again, that's a semi-informed guess.
Thank you, Angie, for the call. Do you think, Jeff, that we'll be marking the 100th anniversary of this assassination the same way that we're marking the 50th? I guess what I'm asking is, it was this presidency, people remember it now. Some of us were alive and we remember that day vividly. But 100 years from now, was there enough in the presidency to make us remember it again in anything like the fashion we're remembering it now?
No, I think it is true that once the generation that was around when Kennedy was killed leaves the scene, it can't. I just don't think it can. I mean, one of the reasons why this is so powerful is that the assassination and the 4 days surrounding it, coming at a time when television was in every American home, linked the country together in an emotionally traumatic experience in a way that nothing else did, not even Pearl Harbor, because Pearl Harbor was something people heard on the radio and then saw in newsreels. I think 9/11 is the closest parallel you could come to what it meant for the country. But I do think that 50 years from now, no, it can have that emotional impact. It's because nobody's going to be around who remembers it. They'll have seen the tapes and the film.
Right.
But, you know, if you're thinking about presidents who leave that kind of mark, you're kind of down to Lincoln. And to some extent, FDR.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Teddy Roosevelt was this, about whom Doris Goodwin has written this splendid book. He was an outsized personality. He was a larger-than-life president, but that was 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's too far away for people to have any kind of emotional impact. We might be, people might be interested in the Kennedy story, but not the way they are now.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we were anywhere near sufficiently interested in the 150th anniversary of Gettysburg. That was a big deal
me,
and it was 16 seconds on the news. Come on.
That's my point.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I'm interested in your work with Bobby Kennedy. You were a speechwriter for him. How did that come about, Jeff?
Again, by accident, like so much in our history does. I was in law school looking to get into a class that was oversubscribed. My professor said, let's see how you perform. I went through hoops. The next day, this professor's friend who was a legislative aide to Kennedy said, you know, what do you know about this guy, Greenfield? And he gave me, based on a thoroughly unrepresentative performance in class, a very good recommendation, and that's how I wound up on his staff. And because Senate staffs are small, you know, I got to work on speeches. Now, it's important to say that Robert Kennedy did not turn to a 24-year-old graduate right out of law school and say, so what do you think I should do about Vietnam, Jeff? But it was still a rather remarkable experience to start your, you know, your grown-up life.
Yeah, well, it's probably just the person you should have asked, a 24-year-old, right?
Well, maybe not.
Yeah. And on the day, I just didn't want to get the audio. I didn't want to do that for this hour because there was so much to talk about. But I am interested in knowing your memories of that day.
I was at the University of Wisconsin.
Hmm.
I was editor of the Daily Cardinal.
Oh, you were? Oh.
Yes. Getting ready to embark on a trip to Southeast Asia with other students around the country.
Oh, my goodness.
Tour,
huh.
Which we later found out was sponsored by the CIA. Anyway, my girlfriend called and said, I just heard the president's been shot. And I said to her, oh, I don't think so. You must have misheard. And turned on the radio because back then, you know, television was a luxury that I could not afford in the little apartment I shared. And the news came on, and I ran to the Cardinal offices and put out, you know, a newspaper, and then spent the next few days in front of whatever television set I could find, watching and mourning and seeing this unbelievable story play out.
Mm. And did you write about it for the school newspaper?
I'm sure I did, yeah. Well, I think if you go back in the files 50
years
ago.
Yeah, you should. You should see what you wrote, huh?
Yeah, I know I did. Sure I did.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that was my job.
Yeah. And tonight there will be a show on PBS. You're on a show on PBS tonight. Is that what you said earlier?
I don't know. I'm doing so much. Charlie Rose has a panel.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if he's running it tonight or tomorrow.
Okay.
With Michael Beschloss and Bob Dalek. And Richard Reeves and Jill Abramson and myself talking about this stuff. But
well,
I don't know which night it's on.
It's either today or tomorrow. Check your local listings. Thank you so much, Jeff, for being with us. It's a fascinating book, and I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Bye. Jeff Greenfield. The book is If Kennedy Lived, the First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy, an Alternate History. It's a really interesting book. It's an interesting thought process he went in writing this book because he knows what was going on during that time period. So it's not just idle speculation. So that's it. Tomorrow, the 50th, I was alive during that time. And, of course, many of us remember that day. If you would like to leave your memories, we didn't want to go that direction this hour because it would have consumed the whole hour. But we're interested in hearing where you were 50 years, for those of you who were alive, 50 years ago tomorrow, because it is one of those days that that you remember. It was not a good day. So go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can either write what you think a second term would have been like for JFK or where you were this day 50 years ago. Isn't that something? 50 years ago. Whew. Well, thanks to KP Whaley and to Robin Cherry for producing and for on-air production of this program. Thanks for your calls, everybody. Central Time is coming up. We'll be with you next on Monday at 1 o'clock. All Things Political, our regular 1 o'clock show, so join us for that. And news from NPR will be on the air momentarily. This is the Ideas Network.